He calls it powered by people, but there's one ex-presidential contender clearly powering the group to prominence. What it could mean for Texas in 2020 today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. With support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. Law enforcement warning that there's a certain type of trafficking on the rise in the borderlands, and it's causing cacti to disappear. Also, why 2020 could turn into a banner year for renewable energy in Texas. Plus, the story of some last-minute angels helping out a shorthanded Santa in some parts of the Lone Star State. It's the national news show of You Know Where, and it all gets started right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this 23rd day of December 2019. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. Have you ever noticed some years, you know, you start in January and you can't stop writing that last year on your checks? You know, notes and that kind of thing. I'm actually having something of a different issue. Twice today, I've almost said 2020 when I meant 2019. I'm not quite sure what that says, if anything, about the year that was, but this gives me an opportunity to make a pitch for a couple of special broadcasts we have coming up here on the Texas Standard. If you happen to be around on New Year's Eve, we'll be exploring the top stories in Texas for 2019. And the next day, New Year's Day, it's a look into the future. The big challenges and trends we can look forward to in Texas for 2020. Both of those broadcasts will feature our next guest, who's literally written the book on politics, actually quite a few books, including one titled Inside Texas Politics, Power, Policy, and Personality of the Lone Star State. Indeed, that last part of the book's title is important because of one of the most significant Lone Star personalities of late, a politician who most recently failed at his last two election efforts, but who managed to build up quite a bit of political equity in the process, something he's hoping to leverage with a political action committee he's just launched. That personality is, as you may have guessed, Beto O'Rourke, the author and political scholar, and our guest on The Standard now is Brandon Rottinghouse at the University of Houston. Brandon, great to talk with you again. Thank you so much.
You too, David.
What exactly is this new PAC that Beto O'Rourke has announced?
This PAC is really a kind of investment in the future. It's a way for O'Rourke, who was an electric superstar for the Democrats in 2018, to kind of invest in the party's infrastructure and to try to generate some kind of interest and energy about the Democratic Party, especially when it comes to winning House seats and Senate seats in the state House, which is complicated and oftentimes underfunded.
In an email to supporters, Beto O'Rourke said that this group, Powered by People, is supposed to bring together volunteers from around the state to work on the most important races in Texas. What strikes me, of course, is that Beto famously worked against or spoke out against using PACs to raise campaign funds when he was running for Texas Senate and again for U.S. president. What do you think? How do you think he rationalizes this move?
I think, you know, his what he said was that basically this is the only way you can really raise political money and spend it. And although it's obviously not what he wanted for his own race, it is something that will help Democrats in the future. And they need a lot of help. It's been more than 40 years since you've seen a significant amount of movement for Democrats statewide. They haven't had control of the state house since 2001, since Scrubs and 24 were on TV for the first time, which is like a lifetime ago. But they're within striking distance. And so a PAC, even if he doesn't necessarily like the precise way it happens, is really going to make the Democrats competitive in a way that they weren't before.
Well, now, question, because John Cornyn has raised an enormous war chest, and you talk about how Democrats are behind. In terms of money, it seems like they're very far behind Republicans here in Texas. Is there a way for him to catch up?
There is. I mean, one of the benefits that O'Rourke brings to the race is that he can generate a lot of interest, and that means money. The way that Democrats can raise money now and small donations from all over the country is going to really accelerate their ability to get some funds into the war chest. O'Rourke himself raised record amount of money in the race that he ran against Ted Cruz. So he knows how to make that work, and he knows how to point that money in the right direction, and that's what Democrats need.
You know, how much of a difference does money make in the modern electoral process? I mean, we've seen several high profile candidates who had tons of money to spend. I mean, you think about, for instance, in the presidential sweepstakes, you have Bloomberg now as a player, and he's spending a lot of money on media. But it's not clear just how much, you know, if that's going to put him over the top. In fact, it's far from clear that it will. So I guess my question is, does money equal political success in terms of modern politics?
It's not a precise estimation. I mean, you're not going to, just because you've got money doesn't mean you're going to win, but it can get you other things. So for me, O'Rourke's PAC can focus on the three R's. The first is raising money, like we've been talking about. The second is recruiting candidates. If you're going to try to get people to leave their jobs temporarily or to take a leave from their family, they've got to be able to have some money to back it. And the Democrats have been doing pretty well. This cycle, they've got a full slate nearly of candidates, 15 out of 16 of the Senate races, 122 out of the 150 House races. That means you've got to have money. So money can give you infrastructure. The second thing it can give you is the ability to connect to voters. The explosion in the voter rolls between 2014 and 2018 was about 2 million people. This record numbers. The problem is one, you need to get your sort of face and you need to get your message in front of those people. And the other is that there are a lot of Texans who are still not registered to vote. By some estimates, about 2 million or 2.5 million. So that's a way for the money to be able to be put to good use, to build an infrastructure and to get eyeballs in front of the Democratic line. And that's what O'Rourke wants.
Of course, Republicans don't quite like the way that this is coming together. They've been flagging O'Rourke's about face on PACs, as the Texas Tribune put it. So it'll be interesting to see if they can make any political advantage from that line. Brandon Rodinghouse is one of many who's going to be watching. He's a political science professor at the University of Houston. Brandon, so nice of you to take a couple of minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard, and we'll talk with you again in about a week or so.
Absolutely. My pleasure, David.
Lifelong urban dwellers sometimes don't acknowledge something that public policy long has. There's a symbiotic relationship between hunting and conservation. We're not just talking circle of life stuff here. In Texas and much of the U.S., hunters actually fund conservation efforts. Public lands are often prime hunting ground. But with the number of hunters on the decline, stakeholders are banding together to attract a different type of hunter, someone not unlike Guns in America's Heath Druzan.
A few weeks back, I found myself being pelted with snow, perched on a ridge high above the aptly named Roaring River in central Idaho. Microphone in one hand, rifle in the other, trying very hard not to trip, my eyes peeled for elk, trudging behind my friend and lifelong hunter, Roger Phillips. How did I get here? Well, turns out there's a name for it.
It's called adult onset hunters. Sounds like a disease, and I guess it's a good disease to have.
That's Lan Tawney, president of the national group Backcountry Hunters and Anglers.
It's really these people that are in their 20s and 30s and 40s, didn't grow up hunting and fishing, and now want to get into it.
His group and a number of wildlife organizations across the country are counting on these so-called adult onset hunters. So much so, they've created a 5-week intensive class called Learn to Hunt. Earlier this fall, a group of aspiring hunters in the class gathered in Boise. They huddled around an elk carcass as Idaho State wildlife biologist Katie Ulrich demonstrated how to skin an animal.
So see how this kind of just pulls right off? How, like, I'm barely doing any cuts, and that just kind of pulls right off.
This is what Paul Nepper signed up for.
As a kid growing up, I always lived in urban areas.
But as he got older, he started feeling a pull.
I wanted to be more involved with nature. And part of that is obviously understanding your food supply and where that comes from.
States are betting on new hunters like Nepper because the number of hunters is declining. 2 million fewer people went hunting in 2016 than went out in 2011. That's according to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. But why should Americans care about the decline of an activity most don't take part in? Fewer hunters means less money for conservation. The bulk of state wildlife agencies' funding comes from hunters, in the form of licenses and taxes on guns and ammo. That same Fish and Wildlife study showed hunters spent nearly $10 billion less in 2016 than they did in 2011.
Across the nation, we had seen a significant decline in hunter and angler participation.
Ian Malapiai is Idaho Fish and Game's marketing manager. but he's really more of a recruiter for new hunters. He says hunting can be intimidating for the inexperienced.
We want to provide as many tools as we can to get people over that mental barrier.
So, back to those snow-dusted mountains. The culmination of the Learn to Hunt course is a mentored hunt. So I called up my friend Roger Phillips, and we trekked into the endless Idaho backcountry. It takes us 3 days, but we finally get close to a herd of elk. Close enough that we have to whisper.
So they look like they're moving down the drainage.
Right. Which... See, this is where it's just like, okay, we don't want to go over that side. We want a side hill. We'd like to stay up above them. But we also want to know what the hell they're going to do.
We see five of them through binoculars feeding on a hillside. The question is, where are they headed? Roger says this game of cat and mouse with big game is part of what he loves about hunting.
And this is where the chess game starts.
We sneak up to within 270 yards. But I can't get a clean shot.
Do you see the animals?
No.
So we take a risk and try to get closer. Our luck runs out. The snow is loud underfoot. Our cover blown, the elk take off. Roger tries to coax them back with a call. But it's too late. They're gone. And we're out of daylight. We got close, though. And I'll be back next year. For Guns and America, I'm Heath Drusen.
Guns in America and our partner station KERA are spending 2 years reporting on the role of guns in American life. You can learn more at gunsinamerica.org. All right, let's find out what Texans are talking about on this next to last Monday of the decade,
I guess it is.
Yeah, Wells Dunbar is our social media editor. What are you seeing?
Hi, David. Impeachment continuing to dominate political talk online. Topic at hand, the House of Representatives is signaling further reluctance to refer its articles of impeachment to the Senate unless it gets assurances that senators won't just mount a show trial. That means the specter of impeachment could loom over President Trump with no clear resolution for an indefinite period of time. Via Twitter, Genevieve tweets us, "I think Nancy Pelosi is a genius." On her Facebook page, Deborah Russell says the move means more squirming time and allows some to dig a bigger hole for themselves. Mark Terrell says it's not a stalemate, it's recess, and Democrats are using the pause constructively. Pelosi is using the media to get out the message that Mitch McConnell is not allowing the Senate to vote on witnesses. Yet Marvin Crane calls the move, along with the entire impeachment proceedings, political theater that will help Trump get reelected. Lots of comments chiming in, people chiming in on that one as well. I'll be back with more from social media later in the show.
You know, one of the news stories that's breaking today, Boeing firing its CEO, making news across the nation and the world for that matter. We'd love to know what's making news in your part of Texas. Tweet us at Texas Standard.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Association of Community Colleges, providing pathways for Texans to advance the individual aspirations of students while focusing on accessibility, affordability, and relevance. More at tacc.org.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Every December in towns across Texas, thousands of people donate time and money for families in need. They buy toys, clothes, stocking stuffers, so those families can have a happy holiday, right? Sometimes, though, donors forget. KERA's Bill Zeeble joins some last-minute angels who dash to stores to help save Christmas by filling up some empty bags.
Hello! Welcome! What do you have for us today?
It's a busy Friday night at the intake table. Donors at Dallas's Holy Trinity Catholic Church drop off bags of new, unwrapped clothes and toys from wish lists they've promised to fill.
Family 53.
By morning, hundreds of recipients will start arriving in shifts at this Oaklawn neighborhood church to pick up their bags. Each bag has a number, and those numbered bags arriving tonight get set out on the gym floor to be checked by volunteers, like Mackenzie Skinner. He goes by Mac.
I am an audit captain, so we're going through all of the gifts our sponsors bring in and checking to make sure we have clothes, shoes, and toys for each of the children sponsored.
Mac takes his job seriously. Here, every kid gets shoes. Auditors check for the right clothing size and that there's at least one toy. If something's missing, volunteer auditor, Carolina Skirchley, passes that on to volunteers who might be called last-minute angels.
Tonight, they'll go shopping for whatever's missing, and then anything that we have that's the wrong size or whatever, we kind of divvy out to whoever can take it.
It happens. Maybe a bag with a size 9 shoe actually needs a size 5. Only things seem worse this year, according to Megan Cole.
There's quite a bit of pieces missing. Some folks forgot to shop entirely and are not coming tonight. And others simply couldn't find the clothing sizes required. And some people just cherry-picked what to shop for and what not for.
So with a list of what's needed in hand, Culp and Emily Vanderwall hop in Andrew Hoffman's Honda, and this angel trio goes shopping. It's not quite 10 p.m. From the back seat, Vanderwall reads the shopping list.
For shirts, we have a medium juniors, extra large men's, 3 to 6 months infant, and 18 boys and extra.
The list is long. At the store, these shoppers spread out, seeking shoes, shirts, a volleyball, and a bunch of pants.
We need 50 by 32, 32, 32, 44, 32, 36, 32.
More than an hour later, it's checkout time. The total between two registers is about $1,000. It'll get reimbursed from donations. Goods go in the trunk, and Halfin's car gets them back to the church on time. The purchased goods go in the right bags.
Is that a flat dress shoe?
Yeah.
Okay, that's going to Julie.
It's 1 a.m. This angel trio heads home. Culp says the long night's been worth it.
It's fun to be part of a community and see different parts of our church community coming together for such a great cause.
Which is why Culp is back bright and early, 6 hours later, ready to hand out gifts, wearing a big smile, and her red and green elf dress. I'm Bill Zeeble in Dallas.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. 2019 has been a roller coaster of a year for the energy industry. Another oil downturn is seemingly upon us. A recent survey from the Dallas Fed estimates that some 8,100 oil and gas sector jobs may be disappearing. But the market for renewables tells a different story. You're probably well aware by now that wind power in the state has exploded in recent years and continued that growth over the course of 2019. Energy insider Matt Smith of Clipper Data joins us now with more. Matt, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thank you, David.
And happy holidays to you, by the way.
Same to you.
Well, as the oil energy industry struggles, other green energy sources in Texas are growing, and a lot of people talking about that. What does the year look like overall? What can you tell us?
So, well, according to the EIA, Texas accounts for 20% of the U.S.'s non-hydropower renewables, which is essentially, you know, wind and solar. And they're expecting for next year that to rise to 22%. So that's a good old increase. If Texas were a country, which some people would like it to be, right?
That's what I've heard, yes.
It would actually rank as fifth in the world behind, if you say that the U.S. is in that as well. Mm-hmm. There's only China, Germany, and India that is actually producing more wind power.
That is an incredible statistic, yeah. I knew that Texas was leading the rest of the nation when it came to wind power. But my gosh, I mean, if you just think about it as an economy unto itself, number five, that's pretty impressive, actually. How did that happen in a state that seems to be so dependent on fossil fuel?
Well, there has been subsidies in place to a certain extent to encourage these things in recent years, but it's also just because of the space and the entrepreneurship and the wind as well there. Which has encouraged this for Texas to account for a quarter of all the wind power generated in the U.S.
I know, given that wind has been so successful, you would think that perhaps that might not be the only renewable that would have a pretty decent shot here in the Lone Star State. To be totally candid, wind power wouldn't be the one that I would first think of. I would think, given all the sunshine that we get here in the Lone Star State, I'm a little bit surprised that we're not a leader in solar power, too. Or are we?
To some extent, yeah. So solar only accounts for about 1% of all the electricity generated in Texas. But that said, there's still enough solar installed to power over 400,000 homes. So from that perspective, you know, it is on the rise. There's more going to be added going forward here as it becomes that much more cost competitive. But even from a business perspective, you have over 750 solar companies operating in Texas. Wow. So it is a fairly booming business. The majority of those are manufacturers and installers. So, yeah, definitely a bright spot, too. You see what I did there?
Yeah, yes, I do. Very clever. But let's roll it back for just a moment, because it's my understanding that even cleverer still would be to find a way to store all of this energy that's being generated. And as I understand it, as you told us in the past, you know, it's only as useful as the capacity that we have to store it. And that's been really the big challenge. It's batteries, yeah. Right? I mean, yeah. Has any progress been made over the past 12 months when it comes to being able to store all that generated power?
Well, we're still a good number of years away from that tipping point to find, the ability to really store on a large scale. But it is happening from a very low base. So battery storage for the Texas power grid is set to triple in 2020.
Wow.
Which sounds great in itself. That said, in terms of the generating capacity of Texas, that only accounts for a fraction of a percent. But that said, it is expected to grow strongly over the next few years, really. So we're going to be looking to get about 7,200 megawatts of storage as we move through into the second half of the decade. And that compares to about 100 megawatts now. So the future is coming, yes.
Matt Smith is tracking it, too. He's director of commodity research at Clipper Data. Matt, happy holidays again, and we will speak with you next year.
Speak to you next decade.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, featuring family festivities to celebrate the holidays, including Moody Gardens Iceland, Downtown Lasers and Lights, shows at the Grand, and more. Event list at galveston.com/holidaymagic. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, whose research has helped bring more than 90 cancer-fighting drugs to the marketplace. Patients can access national clinical trials phases 1-4 in their communities. More at texasoncology.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Texas Republican Ted Cruz is criticizing House Speaker Nancy Pelosi for waiting to send articles of impeachment to the U.S. Senate. The California Democrat has made clear she wants a better understanding of plans for the trial in the upper chamber. Senator Cruz discussed the speaker's decision with Fox News Channel Sunday.
Listen, I think this is a sign of weakness. This is a sign she understands just how weak these articles are.
The U.S. House voted last week to impeach President Trump on charges he abused power and obstructed Congress. The next step in the process is to send the articles of impeachment to the Republican-led Senate, where a trial is held and the 100 senators serve as jurors. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has said he is not an impartial juror. Police officers in Houston can now have a beard while on duty, Houston Public Media's Sasha Cordner reports.
Houston Police Chief Art Acevedo announced the news in a memo last week obtained by the Houston Chronicle. Before the new change, Houston police officers could only grow and wear a beard for fundraisers or certain religious reasons. Across the state, the move is seen as a way to recruit younger officers to the police force. The Dallas Police Department and Travis County Sheriff's Office in Austin have similar policies in place.
Sasha Cordner reporting. Democratic presidential candidate Julian Castro is questioning his party's decision to impose tougher standards to qualify for the primary debate in January. The seventh debate will be held in Iowa January 14th. That's about 2 weeks before the state's 2020 Democratic caucuses. The former San Antonio mayor, who failed to make the debate stage last week and in November, spoke with MSNBC Sunday night.
I understand the idea behind them, and so I don't fault the DNC for trying something, but I think that there's no question they're going to have to go back and reevaluate these thresholds in the future.
So far, only 5 Democrats have met the polling and donor thresholds to qualify for next month's Democratic primary debate. They include former Vice President Joe Biden and Senators Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Amy Klobuchar. Austin health officials have confirmed the first case of measles in Travis County in 20 years. Austin Public Health say they're working with local, state, and federal health officials to create a list of locations where the infected person may have been over the last few days. Measles is a serious and highly contagious viral disease that spread through the air. Those who are unvaccinated are at a high risk of getting infected. According to the Department of State Health Services, Texas has seen an increase in measles cases in 2019. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Texas Mutual Workers' Compensation Insurance, focused on taking care of people and building strong communities throughout the year, and proud to help build more news for the Lone Star State. Texas Mutual Insurance Company.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Trafficking along the southern border is a major concern for law enforcement, human trafficking and drug trafficking, of course, but not just those. Recently, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service released a report saying it had concluded a major operation to thwart cacti traffickers in West Texas. Yes, we are talking about cactus. Cacti. Joining us now to tell us more, Sarah Button, who reported on this story for the Big Bend Sentinel. Sarah, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Now, walk us through the logistics of this. How does a cactus get stolen in the first place, and where do these cacti go?
Well, the traffickers will get the cacti either through private land without permission, or they will go into the state or national park out here and dig them up and take them out. I talked to Karen Little at Sol Ross, and she is in charge of the greenhouse and specialty gardens out there.
That's Sol Ross State University in Alpine.
Yes, that's correct. And she said that there are so many absentee ranch owners out there in this area that that the traffickers can go in and bring in like small machinery and build their own roads on some of these private properties and just take out whole populations of these living rock cacti, just totally wipe them out.
I mean, I guess this in a way speaks to just how broad and vast the landscape is and how people aren't going to be able to patrol miles and miles and miles of property 24/7. There's not enough people, there's not enough cameras, you just can't constantly be patrolling all of that. So what do you do to defend yourself from what sound like rather sophisticated operators?
That is where I'm not sure. I don't know what you do in that. We're in such a remote location that these populations just totally get wiped out. I don't even know how to answer that. I'm sorry.
No, I think that hits right at the heart of it. Mm-hmm. How sophisticated are these operations, and are we talking about one operation, or is it clear whether there are multiple cactus thieves?
Well, there are definitely multiple cactus thieves. So, in a report from the Fish and Wildlife Services from November, they said that they arrested four people specifically and sentenced them to probation and then to pay some restitution and fines. But the case is still ongoing, and there are other people involved in this case. So we don't know the total damage or who's been arrested or what exactly the charges are yet.
What type of cactus do these traffickers appear to be going for, and what is the ultimate destination? I mean, where are they going to sell these cacti?
Yeah, so the type of cactus is the Areocarpus fissuratus, or the living rock cacti. And they're being sold in the black market to people in Europe and Asia who want exotic plants that have gone through, decades of, growing and rain and dust to give it like this really unique, rugged look.
Is there a lot of money in this business?
Yes. So according to what Karen Little told me and what I read in the Fish and Wildlife Service article, the traffickers can get between $500 and $1,000 for shipping one of these living rock cactus overseas. And Special Agent Eric Jumper, who was the lead on the case from the Fish and Wildlife Services, said that in a six or seven-month span, that one of the traffickers made about $300,000 and probably shipped about several thousand plants.
You mentioned that it's hard to know what exactly can be done to crack down on this sort of theft. Do you have a sense of what whether law enforcement is considering this a priority right now?
According to the Fish and Wildlife Services, they definitely are considering this a priority. As you mentioned before, it's such a vast area. It's so hard to patrol. You know, they do have laws out there, although they're pretty vague and just usually end up with fines. You know, it's hard to patrol, you know, every inch and every mile of the state parks, the national parks, and the highways, you know.
Trafficking along the border, cacti trafficking. You can read Sarah Button's latest story on cacti theft in West Texas in the Big Bend Sentinel, and we'll have a link to it at texasstandard.org. Sarah, thanks so much for spending a few minutes with us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you again for having me. I appreciate it.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you. Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
I am Shamil Salhab, and this is my poem called Where I'm From. I'm from snow-covered mountain, from night-blooming jasmine, the special flower of the night that smells like grapefruit. I'm from crispy flatbread my mom and grandma bake each morning on a rock oven near the house, from sweet black tea with fresh bread for breakfast. I'm from big sour lemons on small tree and sweet green grapes growing on vines on wooden frames by my house. I'm from low morning fog over the grass, from tiny seeds for feeding chicken, from colorful flowers surrounding the house. I'm from celebrating Eid, from clubbing and singing at the park, from kids playing and shouting in the neighborhood, from crunchy pistachio and tea cookies. I'm from the Big Stone School. I walk to in my blue uniform dresses with a cap and scarf, from loud, happy lunch in the courtyard, from dusty green chalkboard. I'm from Syria, and those moments I miss. My name is Shaima Salham, and you are listening to the Texas Standard.
Going back home for the holidays can bring with it all sorts of challenges. For some, there's the challenge of getting along with family and navigating the dynamics of different worldviews. There also may be a heightened risk of running into an old classmate or friend, of course, but depending on your holiday plans, these challenges may be more fact than fiction at the moment. The notion was enough, however, to inspire a new novel. The Texas Standard's Joy Diaz introduces us to the book and its author.
I must confess that two Christmases ago, my husband and I hosted, and 30 people were coming in and out of mi casa, que es su casa, and it was craziness. And that's one of the reasons why I so appreciated Benjamin Markovitz's new novel, Christmas in Austin. Some people have called his writing style psychological realism, and please forgive me, but I call it reality TV in print. Benjamin Markovitz grew up in Austin, and he joins us today from London, where he lives. Benjamin, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me on.
So in just 1 week, your novel captures the life of this family. It's a mixed heritage family. They're back in Austin for Christmas. And there's a sort of very, I find Christmas to be a very American celebration, like especially for people of different backgrounds like this German Jewish family.
Yeah, so I celebrated both Christmas and Hanukkah as a kid.
Yeah.
And since my mother is German, we celebrated it German style on Christmas Eve.
Mm.
And as lights on the trees, we used real candles, which always struck my dad as slightly nuts. So we keep a bucket of water with a towel in it next to the tree.
But I'm sure a lot of families in Texas identify with the way you celebrate it. I must tell you that one of the things that I really liked about the book is how you capture the family dynamics. The aging parents, the siblings, you know, giving birth and being grown-ups and having money problems and career problems and even death. I felt like I was eavesdropping on the Essingers.
That's nice to hear. I mean, it really is a book about family. The background of the characters is a little like my background. My dad's a Jew from New York. My mom's a German Christian. And when they married, they sort of cut themselves off from their old lives,
yeah,
and moved to Texas and started, you know, the family that I grew up in. And it just felt like an island in the middle of all this history that had produced their marriage. And the book really is about that kind of island, the island that family life provides people.
And I love that you use the word history because it felt like that. It felt that you were, in a way, giving us a history lesson, but just on the sidelines, like talking about this house in Austin where a servant lived. And you kind of get the idea that the family who had the servant was not far removed from the times of slavery, perhaps.
Well, that's good. That's what I hope for. You know, when you're a kid, you have really no sense of the wider context in which you're growing up. But then as you get older, you realize that you are also the product of world historical forces, that
right,
lots of things and the planet at large had to come together to produce your childhood.
And speaking of recent history and us being a part of it, for many Texans, as you know, many of us come from somewhere else and going back home. They or I, we cannot go back to the family home where we grew up in. When you come to Texas, do you come back to your family home? And how does it
feel? I do come back to my family home. My parents are still living in it. But it's a real problem, isn't it? You know, what to do with these places that have such huge symbolic meaning for people. So the mother of the family is thinking about her son who's going through a rough time, Paul. And on some level, she thinks you can't just move home when bad times hit as if your home is a museum. It has to be a living thing. You have to make a new one. But on the other hand, nobody wants to give up on that museum. And part of what Paul is wrestling with is the sense he had that as a kid, he was happier and more authentic than he has become as an adult. And how do you get back to that sense?
Mm, yeah. When you talk about the mother in this story, I wonder if she is like your mother, because there's one phrase that made me laugh. You say that Liesl is prettier than any of her daughters. And I laughed because my mother is prettier than any of her daughters.
Oh, that's nice.
Is your mother that way?
You know, my sisters are beautiful too. You know, I'm sort of joking, but my mom, when she was a young woman, she met my dad at Cornell, a little like the Liesl in the story. She must have been quite a catch.
Mm.
And I try to convey a little bit of that, even though by the time this book starts, she's in her 70s.
Yeah. One of the things that really touched me as well is when it's not clear that everybody will be able to make it home.
Yes. Actually, one of my favorite scenes in the book, it's a very small scene. The younger daughter, Jean, is on the phone with her brother who is stuck on the East Coast when a storm is about to hit.
Yeah.
That's going to cancel their flights. And she's trying to think of ways that he can get to Austin before the storm hits that involve all kinds of connections and her driving out to Dallas to pick him up. And that's a real drama. You know, sometimes when you're writing novels, you can get caught up in the sorts of dramas that you feel will make a novel seem important. But at Christmas, if you can get a family member to come, that is a drama that will take a day or two of your life and your thoughts. And I wanted to reflect that in the book.
Where will you spend Christmas?
We'll be in Austin. My wife and our two kids will fly out there. They'll have lots of cousins around. And it's the same house that I grew up in.
Wonderful. Benjamin Markovitz is a novelist. His latest is Christmas in Austin. Benjamin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund. For over 10 years, helping families lock in current tuition rates and required fees at Texas public colleges and universities, excluding medical and dental institutions. TexasTuitionPromiseFund.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, dedicated to improving healthcare in North Texas and around the world through pursuits like the new TCU and UNTHSC School of Medicine, educating empathetic scholars. TCU, lead on.
Hey, hey, it's a Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Donald Trump made stopping illegal immigration a centerpiece of his election campaign. Many observers say his administration has made legal immigration harder, too, with more restrictions added to many entry categories from student visas to permits to work in the U.S. As Antonio Cueto reports, visa denials are way up in the past few years, and the result is not only changing our workforce, but the diversity of our artistic talent pool.
Abhi Sridharan grew up all over the world. Born in India, he moved with his family to France, China, and even the Fiji Islands.
All my life, my family has been moving around.
8 years ago, Sridharan came to the U.S. on a student visa to go to college in California. There, he started making music. When his student visa expired, he went to France and came back to the U.S., this time landing in Texas in 2017.
What's up? My name is Abhi the Nomad. Indian rapper, currently living in Austin, Texas.
They call me, yeah, they call me modern trash. I am just a common fad. Wrote myself a letter for the gods. Now it's crumpled in a bottle flask. Took a while to start.
While in Austin, Sridharan began playing a few shows during South by Southwest, gaining experience, developing a portfolio of work, and with all that in hand, he applied for the little-known O-1 visa. It's granted to those applicants who exhibit extraordinary talent.
Might not make it to the top. People telling me to stop. Everything could go wrong. Yeah, never had the world in my hands.
Everyone from musicians, artists, entertainers, actors, actresses, athletes, to astrophysicists, to chefs, to bartenders, to...
That's immigration attorney Jason Finkelman. He says this visa is granted to people who can prove to immigration that they've reached the top of their industry. People like Justin Bieber, Hugh Jackman, John Oliver, and actress Kate Del Castillo are all O-1 recipients. Applying for this visa is not an easy process. The easiest way for someone to get it is through undeniable recognition, like winning a Nobel Prize or a Pulitzer. But because not everyone who's eligible for the visa is at that level, the person who gets to judge the relevance of their work is the immigration officer. And that's where most cases can turn difficult.
I have a client who designed the motion graphics for the way an iPhone would spin in an Apple iPhone ad.
Finkelman can't simply send federal immigration authorities a video of the iPhone graphics themselves. He has to submit everything on paper. Finkelman has to describe in print how the graphics move, why they're so impactful, and provide testimony of others.
So we'd have to get other graphic designers to say, the way that this particular individual was able to manipulate this graphic was revolutionary.
Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah. We looked at that in Miss Laura's class.
O-1 visas are for extraordinary people, but that doesn't necessarily mean they all have to go to Hollywood or become famous. A lot of them decide to stay and contribute to their communities.
In the past, in el pasado, en el año 1800, 1830, en 1800...
Gustavo Bernal works for an educational nonprofit based in Austin called Creative Action. He was a Venezuelan filmmaker in 2003. When he came to the U.S. on a tourist visa. But what he really wanted to do was work. So he met an attorney who helped him get the O-1 visa so he could shoot commercials.
So I work for an advertising agency in New York called Spike DDB. It's run by Spike Lee. I cut two PSAs with Magic Johnson.
But this was easier for Bernal than most. Back in Venezuela, he worked with high-profile clients like HBO Latin America and won film festival awards from all over the world. Now at Creative Action, he hopes to pass along his passion for film to his students.
On that age, I was already interested in this. I wish that when I was a kid, I had this opportunity to meet people like a teaching artist, like myself.
Once granted, an O-1 visa is good for up to 3 years. Immigration attorney Finkelman says while nothing has changed about this extraordinary talent visa, applicants are getting more scrutiny.
We see U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services officers looking with a more strict eye at O-1 visa applications than ever before.
And that's unfortunate, he says. Through this visa, creatives from all over the world get to contribute their uniqueness to the American cultural landscape.
It encourages innovation. It's in the interest of this country to bring the best and brightest talent to this country.
For the Texas Standard, I'm Antonio Cueto.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Well, since you are listening to the Texas Standard, I bet you know what that sound means. It means it's time to check in with our social media editor, Wells Dunbar.
Hello, David.
Hello there.
'Twas the night before Christmas. Mm-hmm. And believe it or not, folks, we're still stirring on the Standard social media properties. Mm. Bless them, everyone. With the holiday seasons here, we wanted to hear from our friends and listeners about their merrymaking plans, and thankfully they are not disappointing. On Facebook, Jordan Peterson says, everyone comes to us this year. No traveling. It's been great so far. And I gotta co-sign that. There is nothing better. Yeah. We all love our friends and family. Why do we have to limit it just in the holidays, you know? Mm. Why do we have to all cram into metal tubes together and cough over each other to cram everything into just a couple days there? Mm. Jeff Martinez says he's going down a San Antonio to celebrate, while over on Twitter, Sherry writes that she is ensconced in rural Illinois. She's flying home to Texas the day after Christmas. Already bumped into a guy who turned out to live near me in Clear Lake. It's a teeny tiny world we live in. It certainly is, as we are reminded over the holidays. And another vivid holiday description, this impressionistic dispatch via Twitter.
What do you mean?
Well, from Jose Francisco Fonseca, he is describing his holiday plans. And he always, a regular listener, chimes in with some pretty sort of poetic writings via Twitter. This is how he describes the holidays: a kitchen clanging in chaos as aunties argue over who made a better pozole, a living room littered in torn teal, maroon, yellow, and silver wrappers from flayed gifts, and a Christmas tree tilting and tapping at a window, ready to run out of here, leaving a trail of tinsel. And, you know, hopefully, folks, holidays are a little sunnier than that, although they can be a tough time of year. So always a good reminder to treat yourself well over the holidays, and you'll, I would imagine, treat everyone else well as well.
How about that?
Yeah.
I'm just reading a story that's kind of fascinating from the Houston Chronicle. Did you know the youngest mayor in America took office on Sunday in Whitehall, Texas?
I did not know that. News
William
to me.
Charles Charlie McMillan. He's 7 months old. And according to his father, the new honorary mayor's motto is Make America Kind Again. That's according to KWTX in Waco. Trying to understand exactly. Oh, I see what happened. Mm-hmm. Charlie won an annual auction for mayor at the Whitehall Volunteer Fire Department barbecue fundraiser this year.
Okay, good
so
for
he's
Charlie.
Good. Yeah, so he gets named. It's quite a gift.
7 months.
To be,
yeah, that's something to go. Something to put on the resume. There, yeah, going forward.
I guess so. Charlie may be too young to be mayor, but who knows? I mean, I hear that a seat may be opening up in the Texas House of Representatives, and so well, I don't know. We're not altogether sure about that. Listen, we're out of time for the big broadcast. But we're going to be back here tomorrow, and we hope you will join us. Till then, I'm David Brown, along with Wells Dunbar and the rest of the team, wishing you a marvelous Monday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family.